Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the richest nation in the world right after this. You know, here's an interesting statement. It says, "Then Peter and the other apostles answered and said, 'We ought to obey God rather than men.'" You can read that in Acts 5, verse 29. You know, that's a pretty revolutionary concept, but it's impossible to put into practice unless you personally know the law. Can you imagine yourself actually telling a policeman or a judge that the law of God supersedes the law of your state? Well, there are actually three sources of authority that support Peter's position here in Acts 5, verse 29. The first one is the First Amendment to our Constitution. That's number one. The second is Public Law 97-280, enacted by Congress back in 1982. And then the third one comes from our Supreme Court. It's called Seeger versus United States. That's the third. Now, do you know the scriptural law to cite in support of your position, for instance, on the census or public schools, Social Security, vaccinations, or the many other laws of the scripture that conflict with the laws of your state? And do you know how to look them up, how to research them out, or code plead the law to use the scripture to defend yourself against state and federal intrusion into your constitutionally protected rights? Because if you don't know the law of the scripture and you don't know the law of your state, then you're in no position to challenge either one, are you? Now, if you're tired of being a Bible illiterate and the police and public officials kicking sand in your face, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package? It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our Mosaic Law School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on to our archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there off the Internet, georgegordon.org. All right, last time we were talking about the richest nation in the world. I told you about a young woman that was on the Lair NewsHour, and she said that national health care insurance is an American right. You have a right to that. Well, President Obama and the Congress just gave you national health care insurance. I thought about that and said, well, gee, if health care insurance is a right, how about a Lexus or a new home? There are other things, you know, out here that we could turn into rights, I guess, if we wanted to. I guess everybody has a right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. That's what our founding fathers thought. They didn't put in public school. They didn't think that was a right. They didn't put in health care insurance. They didn't think that was a right. Fortunately, those of us alive today have come to the point where we recognize the errors now of our founding fathers, and we've corrected their mistakes. We didn't have to go to the Constitution to do it either. We just did it by statutory legislation. How's that for a plan? Now, there's another side to this story. Because I got to thinking about the richest nation in the world, and I thought, after thinking about it for a while, that a nation, if it were the richest nation in the world, wouldn't have any national debt. So I discovered I discussed this with you yesterday. I said, look, this debt thing over here, if debt equals wealth, America is indeed the wealthiest nation in the world. No two ways about it. I mean, we've got the biggest debt of any nation in the history of the world. We've got the biggest debt of any nation in the world today, and not quite per capita. Now, I told you about Monaco. They've got a $500,000 debt per individual citizen. But their balance sheet's a little better than ours. All the people in Monaco or Monaco is a millionaire. So that being the case, they can afford a little more debt on their balance sheet than the average Joe Sixpack. But we've got a $333,333.33 debt for every American. Now, that includes your national debt, and it includes your mortgage, car payments, big screen TV payments, all of the debt, your credit cards. If we put all this debt together, it's about $100 trillion. And they tell us that, you know, that at some point in time we're supposed to pay that off. I don't think that our debt here in the United States is serviceable. I don't think that we have enough national income in the United States to pay the interest on $100 trillion worth of debt. And it gets a little worse than that as we progress along. I think we're going to default on that debt, and we're going to get an opportunity to test the richest nation in the world and find out whether or not all of this debt that cannot be serviced in reality translates into real wealth. That opportunity is coming, and not too far in the future. So my thinking was that if you were living in the nation that was the richest nation in the world, you'd have no national debt, you'd have a positive balance of payments, and you'd have an agricultural surplus. And in the Bible, in Deuteronomy 15, verse 6, and in Deuteronomy 28:12, and I showed you that yesterday, that God himself said, here's what I'm going to give you. I'm going to give you these blessings, and one of these blessings in verse 12 is, you shall lend unto many nations, and you shall not borrow. That strikes me as being the hallmark of a wealthy nation as opposed to being a nation of paupers. And in Leviticus 26, verse 10, he said that we would have an agricultural surplus every year. Well, let me read it to you. He says here in verse 10, it says, you shall eat old store and bring forth the old because of the new. That there would be old store, that is, we would have so much food that we'd have it stockpiled, and we'd bring forth the old because we have to get rid of it in order to have a place to put the new. And I showed you yesterday, you know, the average American lives out of the supermarket with just-in-time delivery. You, if you're average, have a 3-day supply of food. If you're a little above average, you might have a week. If you're a fanatic, you might have a 30-day supply. If you're a right-wing, reactionary, lunatic fringe, you might even have a year. And beyond that, you should probably be locked up in a mental hospital. When I was a kid, we all had a year's supply of food. We didn't have a 3-year supply, but I'll show you here as we progress along. In the Bible, in Leviticus chapter 25, there's a program outlined in the scripture where every family in the nation would have a 3-year supply of food. Yeah, 3 years. Can you believe that? I don't know. This God here in the Bible, he's kind of a lunatic fringe, I guess. But let's take a look at three more here today. I think that the richest nation in the world would have a money with real value of 100% of its face value. That's a wild concept. A dollar that's actually worth 100 cents. I think the richest nation in the world would have a citizenry with no doctors and no hospitals. And then, finally, number 6, I think that the nation that is the richest nation in the world would produce more than it consumes. Wild new concept. Let's try it. Number one, we should have no national debt, and we should have a positive balance of payments and an agricultural surplus. I think we should have a money with a real value of 100% of its face value. We should have healthy citizens with no doctors and hospitals and produce more than we consume. Those are the first six indices that I would rank. And as a matter of fact, that's the way the Bible ranks them. That's the way God Almighty, our Creator, laid out the richest or wealthiest nation in the world wouldn't have any national debt, would have a positive balance of payments, would have an agricultural surplus, would have money with a real value of its face value, would have healthy citizens with no doctors and hospitals, and would produce more than it consumes. Now, I wrote out 22, I just took them right here from Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. So if you want to know where I got this idea, I wasn't smart enough to think of it for myself. I looked it up in the Bible, I looked it up in the scripture, and God Almighty, the Creator, He came up with 22 standards that would define the richest nation of the world in the world. And here's a kicker. The United States of America had all 22 of these at one time in our history. There was a time when the United States of America was the richest nation in the world, and today I can report to you, we haven't got a single one of these 22 indices working for us that would indicate that we have any wealth at all. In fact, we have every indice that would indicate that we're poverty-stricken and poor. Poverty-stricken. Now, we're still driving around in our Rolls Royce. I told you yesterday about a guy I knew in Salt Lake City back in 78, 79, 80. You know, when that bubble burst back there in that recession. He had three Rolls Royces. Now, listen. This guy, I thought, had a lot of money. And I imagine he had a pretty good balance sheet. He had to have a pretty good balance sheet in order to get credit to buy three Rolls Royces. Lived in a nice house, had a brokerage. He's a real estate broker. And I don't know how many salesmen he had working for him, but he had salesmen working there. Whether it's 5 or 50, I couldn't tell you. But, you know, a pretty successful guy. Now, listen. A month before they repossessed his three Rolls Royces, he was still driving all three of them. 29 days before they repossessed him, he was still driving all three. You know, up until the day that they actually took them, up until the day that they actually took the keys to his house and evicted him, he had all of the appearances of wealth, even though he wasn't making his payments and he was in the process of foreclosure. Here in the United States of America, we still have all of the trappings of wealth, even though we are right now, as I speak, going through the process of foreclosure. Around the world, nations around the world, are waking up to the fact that United States dollars, you know, our paper money, does not have a value commensurate with the numerals on the face of it. And they're waking up to the fact that we do not have a positive balance of payments. And they're waking up to the fact that our national debt and our combined personal debts in the country amount to more than we can service, more than we can pay. And I'm not just talking about the payments. I'm telling you, you can't even service the interest on this debt. You Americans do not have enough money now to pay the interest. And what you're doing is monetizing debt now. And the rest of the people in the world, you know, those that can count, you know, most people can't count, but there are some that can. And I'm sure that the leaders in China and Japan and South Korea and Germany, and I mean, those people, they can count, and they're taking a look at their portfolios and are taking a look at their position, and they can see that they're not going to get paid. And at some point in time, I think they're going to cut us off. Well, if they got any brains at all, they will. Now, that's not good for us. Now, what's good for us is if we want to count debt as wealth, if we can con these people into continuing to give us more and more actual property, and take for that worthless promises to pay in the form of paper. And if they will do that, then we can profit at their expense and at their ignorance. Well, that would be great. But historically, people don't do that forever. There comes a point in time. And just like the broker in Salt Lake City, you know, there came a point in time. I'm sure that the car company didn't want to take the three cars back, and I'm sure that the bank didn't want to take his house. But when it became apparent, when it became obvious that this guy's business model couldn't support that debt, well, then they had to foreclose and take away from him the collateral. And that's what's in the process of going on in the United States. They haven't taken it yet, but they're in the process of getting ready to. So I thought I'd point that out to you, because if you're still delusional and believe that the United States is the richest nation in the world, then perhaps maybe this series of programs will help you along that line. Now, let's take a look here at the Communist Manifesto, which calls for, here's the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, calls for the abolition of property and land and the application of all rentable land to public purposes. It's what I call the 10-plank model. The opposite to that is thou shalt not steal. That comes from the Ten Commandments. And the Ten Commandments model, which is what our Constitution is modeled after, holds a clause at Article 1, Section 10, that says no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. Those 17 words in Article 1, Section 10 are taken from a model from Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36, and Deuteronomy 25, verses 13 through 16, which say, in effect, you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. That's the way it's worded in Proverbs. In other words, the money that you're dealing with should have a face value, and it should have a real value that are commensurate with one another. Now, in 1930, we used to use gold and silver coin as the foundation of our monetary system. We had paper out there, but you could take a $20 bill into the bank, put it on the counter, and walk out with a $20 double eagle gold coin. And in the process of doing that, you had full convertibility between gold and paper. Now, in 1933, President Roosevelt called in all the gold, took our gold away from us, and there was an important reason for doing that. You see, President Roosevelt wanted to institute or install this first plank to the Communist Manifesto. He wanted to abolish property and land and the application of rent of land to public purposes. And to do that, you have to take away from people their ability to pay and reduce them to the necessity of discharge. I know those are legal terms, and they're kind of esoteric, but the difference between the two is one of them pays the debt and abolishes and extinguishes it. That's property for property. That's payment in gold. The other, the use of that $20 bill, doesn't extinguish the debt, doesn't pay it. It transfers the debt, moves the debt from one person to the next. And there's a case on that. There's actually a story that goes along with that. And I'll see if I can find it here for you. It's called Stanek versus White, and kind of explains it, I think, in layman's language, or at least it helps in layman's language. It comes from Stanek versus White, and it's cited at 172 Minnesota 390. 172 Minnesota 390. Stanek, S-T-A-N-E-C, in case you want to look it up and check me out. There's a clear distinction between a debt that is discharged and a debt that has been paid. When a debt is discharged, it is not extinguished. It continues to exist. When a debt is discharged, it changes its character. A debt paid is extinguished. It is terminated. It is absolved. It is wiped out. But when a debt is discharged, it continues to exist. A person who accepts the discharge agrees that there is a disability that he accepts as a condition of the discharge. That disability that he accepts is the loss of his property, the loss of his property right, and he loses both the money and the product or the service. And he accepts this disability, and he accepts it voluntarily in exchange for the profit that he makes on the transaction. Now, I know that may be a little esoteric, but let me explain it to you in a little simpler term here. When I was a little kid, my daddy used to send me down to Harry Connick's Corner Grocery. It was about a block away from our house. Now, I'm just a little tyke, you know, I'm about 5 years old, and so he'd write up a 3x5 card. And he'd write something on there. I couldn't read it, but I could just about imagine what it says. It says something like, "Dear Harry, please give little Georgie a quart of milk and a loaf of bread." Then he would sign it Daddy Gordon. And then he might put a little postscript on there that says, "I'll pay you when I see you." So my daddy would give me that card, or my granny or somebody, and they'd say, "Now you go down to Harry Connick and give him this note." And I'd go down to Harry's store, and old Harry would take the note and give me a little bunch of grapes and ask me how I was doing today. And sometimes he'd, if he was out in the garden, he'd explain something about growing cabbages and lettuce. You know, he used to grow stuff right there and then sell it in the store. And he used to have cows there, and he'd milk those cows, and I used to go down and watch him milk cows and one thing and another. Right there, right in the city limits of Eureka, California. Can you believe that? So old Harry would take that, and he'd go in the store, and he'd go get the bread and the milk, and he'd put it in a bag for me. And then he'd walk me over to the door, and he'd help tuck that bread and milk up under my arm so I could carry it. And then he'd give me an instruction. He'd say, "Now you go right straight home, little Georgie, with this bread and milk for your daddy." So I'd walk across the threshold of his store door, and I'd walk on up the street and take my bread and milk home to daddy. Okay, now, a legal question comes up. While little Georgie is walking home that one block, about halfway home, this legal question comes up. Who owns this bread and milk? Who is the legal owner of the bread and milk at this juncture of time? We're in transit. Now, Harry doesn't have the bread and milk anymore. He voluntarily gave it up. And he alienated himself from it. In law, we say this is an alienation. So Harry has alienated himself from his bread and milk. He has exchanged the bread and milk for a note. And the note now says, "P.S. I'll pay you when I see you." We don't have an amount on here, but it would be about 35 cents, 30 or 35 cents, something like that. In 1944 or 45 dollars. Now, little Georgie's in possession, and we see in Anglo-Saxon administration that possession is the law, or at least it's 9 points of the law, they used to tell me. Possession's 9 points of the law. Harry's not in possession, but my daddy's not in possession either. So looking at it from that perspective, I'll just ask you the question, who do you think is the owner of the bread and milk? Is it Daddy Gordon, who's not in possession and who has not paid for it? Is it Harry, who's not in possession and has not been paid for it? Or is it little Georgie, who hasn't paid for it but is in possession? Now, when you ask a class of people, you know, you get 6 or 8 or 10 people here in class, and you ask that question, the class will break up into three groups. There'll be some that will say, "Well, little Georgie owns the bread and milk because possession is it." And the group will split and they'll say, "No, Harry still owns the bread and milk. He may not be in possession of it, but, you know, it's like the bank owning your car. They may not be in possession of it. You've got the car, but if you don't make your payment, they're going to come take it back away from you. And once in a while, not very often, but once in a while, somebody will come up with a cock and any idea that Daddy Gordon owns the bread and milk. He hasn't paid for it, isn't in possession of it. But somehow they think that maybe he might own the bread and milk. So, and if you're sitting there in Radio Land, why don't you think about that for a moment? Remember, Harry hasn't been paid, but he does have the note. He takes that note and he puts it in his cash register, but he puts it under the drawer. You ever notice how they do that? They take those big bills and they raise the drawer up and they slide the checks underneath the drawer. And well, that's what he did with these 3x5 cards. He'd slip them under the drawer. All right. Well, if you thought that little Georgie owns the bread and milk, that's incorrect as a matter of law, because little Georgie is an agent. In this case, he's not only an agent, but he's also of minority agency. So if you think that Greyhound Package Express owns the package while they've got it in transit, that's incorrect. Agents don't own the property. They may hold it. They may be a holder in due course, but they're not the owners of the package. And little Georgie is not the owner of the bread and milk. He's an agent, and he's a minority agent. He's underage to start with. So he's out of the game. So this means that it has to be either Harry or Daddy. Harry hasn't been paid, and it was his originally. Harry has a note, and if Daddy doesn't pay him, he can sue on that note. Yes, that's correct. Harry can sue on the note. He could take my daddy into court and say, hey, this guy didn't pay, and then I want him to pay, and he could sue, and he'd be successful, too. He'd be successful on that note. And so, of course, the idea that Daddy Gordon owns the bread and milk is pretty preposterous coming out of the chute. I mean, very seldom you ever come up with anybody that comes up with a wild idea like that. So, if you thought that Harry still owns the bread and milk because he hasn't been paid and he has a note that he can sue on, it's true, he can sue on the note, but he can never have his bread and milk back. He's never entitled to bread and milk. He's entitled to monetary damages. He might even get exemplary damages or punitive damages or something else, but he's never going to get his bread and milk back. And he's never entitled, as a matter of law, to his bread and milk because he alienated himself from it. And that's the way you change the ownership of property, is by alienation. And he's done that. Well, then that only leaves one guy left, doesn't it? There's only one other person involved in this transaction. And that's Daddy. And, of course, you. I know it sounds really crazy. It really sounds preposterous. But the moment that Harry Connick transferred by alienation the bread and milk to Daddy's agent, little Georgie, at the threshold of the door of the store, when little Georgie walked out of there, Daddy Gordon, as a matter of law, became the owner of the bread and milk. Now, it's true he has a debt to Harry, and it's true that Harry can sue on the debt, and it's true that Daddy is liable for the debt. No doubt about that. But Harry's never entitled to his bread and milk back. And that bread and milk belongs to Daddy forever. The transaction's been made, and that's the end of the argument. So Daddy Gordon becomes the owner. Now, going back here to Stanek versus White, there's a clear distinction between a debt that's discharged and a debt that's been paid. Now, let's try this transaction again and see. What if Daddy Gordon had actually given little Georgie 35 cents and sent little Georgie down, and Georgie gave the 35 cents, that is silver coin, to Harry, and Harry rang it up in his cash register and put it in the top of the drawer? Now what do we have? Now we have a payment. We have a payment. And the payment obliterates the debt. It extinguishes the debt. Now, Harry cannot sue Daddy. He doesn't have any grounds for suit. He's been paid. There isn't any debt. There has been a transfer of property. Harry has traded his bread and milk for silver coin. He could have traded his bread and milk for a Ouija board or for a hula hoop or for a pocket knife if he wanted to, but he wanted monetary compensation, and he got it in the form of gold or silver coin. And that actually paid and extinguished the debt. Little Georgie still isn't the owner of the bread and milk. He's merely the agent. Daddy becomes the owner upon payment. And what it does is it takes out of the loop the possibility that Harry might sue for the restitution of his damage. And that's then the explanation as to who owns and who doesn't own. Now, there's another step in the scenario here. And I'll tell you a little story here, and then we'll take our break. One time, I was in my apartment at 1418 Central Avenue in Alameda, California, and there was a knock on the door one Saturday morning. And I answered the door, and there was a bright, energetic young man standing there, about my age. He was probably in his early 20s. I was 23. I would guess he was about my age. And he had a clipboard in his hand, and he said, "Are you Mr. Gordon?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, I'm Joe Simoli, and I'm from the Alameda Property Tax Office, or the County Assessor's Office, and I'm here to appraise or to assess." He used the word assess. "I'm here to assess your property." And I was living in apartment number one, and across the hall was apartment number two. See, I had the manager's apartment. The manager didn't like that apartment, so he wanted the other one. And so he was in apartment two. Now, across the hall, it said manager right on the door, but for some reason, I thought, well, he must have made a mistake here, see? And I said, "Well, you got the wrong guy. What you're looking for is the manager across the hall." And so he looked down on his board again, and he said, "Are you Mr. Gordon?" And I said, "Yes." He says, "Oh, no, I've got the right party." And I was really dumbfounded. Here he was, here to assess the property, and I'm not even the manager. And just goes to show you how dumb I was. I never was the sharpest marble in the drawer. I never claimed to be. And he wanted to come in, and I said, "Excuse me, but what do you want to come in for? What are you going to do when you get inside?" He said, "Well, I'm going to take an inventory of your personal property. We want to see, you know, how much furniture you've got and what its value is, and clothes and paintings and guns and things like that." And I said, "What's that got to do with property?" He says, "It's personal property." And I said, "Personal property? Personal? Excuse me, are you telling me that you want to come into my apartment and you're going to take a look and see how many guns I've got and how many paintings I have on the wall, and you're going to count up my dressers and open my drawers and count my socks, and then you're going to total that up and then tax me?" And he said, yes, that's the Alameda County personal property tax. Boy, you talk about being surprised now. I'll show you how dumb I was. And I said to the young fellow, I said, "Son," well, I didn't call him son because he was about my age, you know, but if it was today, I'd have to call him son. I said, "Listen, you see that threshold down there? See, when I was a kid, I thought that a man's home was his castle. And there's a threshold, you know, on your apartment door. It's just a board down there, just a little rise underneath the door. It's called the threshold." And I said to him, I said, "You see that threshold down there?" I said, "If you step across that threshold, there's going to be blood everywhere, and a lot of it's going to be yours. Now get the hell out of here while you can still do it." And he did. He left. I never saw him again. Now, looking back on that, that was a legal confrontation, And the young man was correct, and I was the guy that was wrong. Now let's take our break, and when we come back, I'll explain why. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, it's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour, an editorial review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the richest nation in the world. Let me give you a wise old saying before we continue. When you're dealing in business, never risk more than you can afford to lose. Never risk more than you can afford to lose. Today's wise old saying. All right, now with that out of the way, I gave you a little legal problem here. I told you a story about the Alameda County assessor. He came and knocked on my door, said he wanted to assess my personal property. And I told him to leave. He left. Now, I got to thinking about that. I didn't think too much or too deeply about it, but just recently, prior to that event, I had gone down to the White Front department store and bought a five-drawer chest. I paid $140 for that five-drawer chest, which in those days, that was more than a week's work. More than a week's work. I got paid $128.40 a week, net, after tax. I paid $140 for that, plus the sales tax. I'm pretty proud of that dresser. It was a nice one. And I thought about the way I paid for it. Now, when I paid for that, I paid for it with $20 bills. $20 bills. Seven $20 bills and a little change to pay the sales tax. And on the $20 bill, In fact, I'm going to just reach right here into my desk drawer while I'm talking here to you, and I'm going to open my drawer, and then I'm going to pull out one of these $20 bills. I got one right here. $20 bill. And on the face of this bill, it says Federal Reserve Note. Federal Reserve Note. Remember that note we were talking about that I took from my daddy and gave to Harry Connick? A legal question arises. When little Georgie Gordon goes down to the White Front store and buys a dresser with Daddy's note, seven of Daddy's notes, $20 bills, and walks out of the store with the dresser, who owns that dresser while little Georgie is driving home? Is it the White Front store? Is it little Georgie Gordon, who's in possession? Or is it the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States? What do you think, boys and girls? Now, remember when we started our conversation here today, we read the first plank to the Communist Manifesto. Do you remember that? Let me show you what that first plank calls for again. It says that what we want to do here is we want to abolish property and land and the application of all rent of land to public purposes. Now, here in America, we have abolished private property. Now, take a look at this, and let's think about this for a minute as we apply this debt. You have a house. You're living in a house right now, as I speak. And when we ask you the question, well, whose house is this? Well, this is my house. Are you a homeowner? Yeah, I'm a homeowner. Are you making a mortgage payment on that every month? Well, two-thirds of you people out there are going to say, well, yes, I'm going to make my mortgage payment this month. One-third of you people out there are going to say, no, sirree, Bob, I own this house free and clear. And I'm going to tell you that neither one of you own that house. Neither one of you. That's not property that you're dealing with there. That's commercial paper. And what you're dealing with there is the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, the abolition of all right to property. That occurred when President Roosevelt took your gold away from you in 1933, and when Lyndon Johnson took your silver coin away from you in 1964. You have not paid for that house. And you people that think that you own it free and clear are paying rent on it every year. It's called a property tax. And that property tax is the prima facie evidence that you don't own it. Because if you don't pay that property tax, the owner of the property is going to evict you and take it away from you. And if you don't make your mortgage payment and your property tax, then the bank is going to evict you and take the property away from you. Now go look up the word property, boys and girls. Property. Property means that you own something to the exclusion of everybody else in the universe. And the word universe is used in the definition in Bovier. If God Almighty Himself can take that away from you, you don't own it. Now, there are some species of property that you can own. In the Bible, you are told that you can go out and dig brass and iron and gold and silver out of the hills. You can own that. In Exodus 19, verse 16, through Exodus 24, verse 8, you'll find the Old Covenant contract. You ought to test this on your preacher next Sunday when you go to church. Ask your preacher if he can tell you in the Bible where the contract is located. Where's the Old Covenant contract? I'll bet you your preacher couldn't find it with both hands at high noon with a road map. But you can, because I just told you where it was. And in that Old Covenant contract over there, there's a wide variety of things that you can own to the exclusion of God. Hell, even God himself won't touch it. Now, there's one species of property over here that many people think that they own some a lot of. It's called land. Let me show you a statute here. It's in Leviticus 25, verse 23. The only thing on this planet, we're talking about planet Earth now. Now, I can't speak for Mars and the moon, but here on planet Earth, where the Bible does have something to say, there is a species of property that you can not own, and that's land. And the statute says the land shall not be sold forever, because the land is mine, for you are strangers and sojourners with me. So here's God. He claims that all the land on planet Earth belongs to him. And he didn't do that with no good reason. He let you have the gold. He let you have the silver. He let you have the trees. And you've given that all away. Now the Federal Reserve, your government, or Satan owns it. You don't. And you're paying rent on it. You don't even own your home. You're paying property tax and mortgage payments on it. You don't own your automobile. You have to register it every year. That's the rent that you pay to the state for the use of their car. And you said, well, that's my automobile. I've got the title. No, you don't. There isn't a one of you people out there that's got the title to your car. You've got the certificate of title. Now go look up the word certificate. Go look up the word title. The title would be the prima facie evidence of ownership, but you don't have the title. You've got the certificate, and the certificate says there's a title that exists someplace, and it's the state of California that's got the title. They've got that at the DMV in Sacramento. And you're carrying the state's identification plates, the flag of the state of California, on both ends of your car. And both ends of your car shows that it's a vessel, and you're the captain, and you're licensed to operate the state's vessel on their rivers of tire, to steer it around islands and back up to docks. Those are maritime terms. Comes from bottomry. You're a maritime sea captain and you're acting in commerce. State owns the car. State owns your house. That's evident by the fact that you're paying a property tax. And why was that? You never extinguished the debt. You discharged the debt. You moved the debt from one person to another, but you never extinguished it. The state owns it. The Federal Reserve owns it. And the first plank to the Communist Manifesto has replaced thou shalt not steal. Now, the reason you have to have a law that says thou shalt not steal is because that's the law that guarantees private personal property ownership. And we're not practicing that. And you can't have private property unless you pay for it. You have to alienate the seller's claim. And you can only do that by payment. And you don't have any way to pay. You are discharging. Now, you got another disability here. Let me show you what that is. How many of you people out there have a Social Security account number? Now, write this down so that you can see where your contract is. You go to Title 42, Section 301 through 335. President Roosevelt, being a very crafty fellow, he gave you something that you wanted. And he gave you something that you wanted at somebody else's expense. And he said, come down here and sign up for Social Security, and if you'll do that, we'll give you this old age pension, unemployment insurance, workman's compensation. Now we have 108 benefits that are associated with Social Security. Now you're going to have 109. You're going to have national health care insurance. Isn't that special? And they're going to be administered by the IRS, and it's going to be, it's going to be administered through Social Security and enforced through the IRS. And in this program over here, you promised, you gave, you alienated all of your labor for all of your life. That's right. And that's what you did when you got your Social Security number. You alienated yourself from your labor for all of your life in favor of the Social Security Administration. And in the process of doing that, now you don't own your labor. Your government owns your labor. And that's why every time you work someplace, you've got to, when you earn $400, you got to make a report to Social Security and pay them the Social Security tax. If you go over to your neighbor Bob, and then you say, Bob, what can I do to help you today? And Bob says, listen, here's what you could do to help me. Go get your rototiller and come over here and rototiller my garden. And then in reciprocity for that, I will take my riding lawnmower and come over and I will mow your grass. The law requires, and you agreed to this when you signed up, that you would reduce this to fair market value. How much is your time worth rototilling your friend Bob's garden, and how much is his time worth mowing your grass, and that you'd pay your tax on it, your Social Security tax? Now, you don't do that, but you're supposed to. It's called fair market value. That's the fair market value rule. Now, when you don't do that, that's called the underground economy. It's actually the free market economy, but it's the underground, it's the black market is what you're dealing in. And some people get pretty crafty at it, you know. I mean, they don't have real jobs out in the real world. They have these free market jobs, these black market jobs, and they work under the table. They work under the counter. They don't pay their taxes. Now, that's the implementation of this abolition of property and land and the application of the rent of that land. The abolition of property and land and the application of all rent of land to public purpose. And we got that with Franklin Roosevelt back in 1933. Now, let me show you a couple more here. Do you send your children to public school? Public school. Remember that one? Free education for all children in public schools. All right, that's the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto. Did you go to public school? Did you know that that's what you were practicing was the 10th plank to the manifesto? Here's the 5th plank. It calls for the centralization of credit in the hands of the state. That's called the Federal Reserve Bank in this country, by means of a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly. That's the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. Let me ask you this. Have you got a checking account, savings account, credit cards? Do you receive a check from your boss? Do you cash your check? Do you endorse the back of that commercial paper? Got a credit card? You're practicing the 5th plank to the Communist Manifesto. 2nd plank calls for a heavy progressive or graduated income tax. Are you paying an income tax? Have you got a state income tax? Is it a heavy progressive and graduated income tax? That's the 2nd plank. I can take you through all 10 planks. I just wanted to hit a couple of 3 of them and show you that what's happened here in America. We have made a conversion from the 10 commandment model. The 10 commandment model of economics to the 10 plank model of economics. And as a result of that, we don't own anything. And you can't own anything because you can't pay for it. Now, fortunately, here in the United States, Australia, Canada, and a few other places in the world, governments have been minting gold and silver coin. You Canadians have it. You Australians have it. We have it here in America. And we can actually buy, sell, and trade with gold and silver. We can actually extinguish our debts. We could actually own things here if you put your mind to it. We could actually work our way out of debt. We could pay our debts at law under Stanek versus White, and we could actually own things. Well, you can't own land. God himself won't let you do that. But you could own just about everything else if you put your mind to it. And that's why I thought I would bring this to your attention, that there is a disability that most Americans have. And as a result of that, we have an illusion of wealth here. We believe that we're a lot wealthier than we really are. But it's worse than that. We not only don't have the physical wealth or the ownership, but we also have a debt in addition to We've got this debt. This debt per capita amounts to about $333,000 per person. Not the highest in the world. There are other people in the world that have higher per capita debt. But the thing that makes the debt in the United States so bad and our position so vulnerable is that our debt is unserviceable. Unlike the debt in Monaco, the people of Monaco can pay their debt off. Bill Gates can pay off his $333,000 debt, but it's most of the rest of us out here who don't have $333,000 per person. You know, if you're the head of family and you've got three or four children, let's say that there's six people in your family, four to six people. Now just take that and multiply that by $333,333.33 and then say, okay, I got to write a check for this amount of money to clear our debt. And like as not, you don't have the money to do that. So a question arises, well, could you make payments on it and could you pay that debt off over time? Well, over the past 50 years, we have not paid a dime on our debt. And our debts have continually escalated from 1933 until today. Until today, we owe this $333,000. And President Obama is indebting you even further. He just signed you up for another $29.1 trillion worth of debt. So the $100 trillion that we owed here a couple of years ago, when I first did these calculations, has now escalated to $129.1 trillion. Our president promises us a $1 trillion plus federal deficit for the next 9 years. So our federal debt of $14 trillion is going to go up to $23 trillion over the next 10 years or so. Then in addition to that, don't you still have to live? Aren't you still going to continue buying, selling, and trading and doing what you've always done? And isn't that going to add more debt? Now the question arises, well, are these debts serviceable? Can we, if we put our minds to it, actually pay these debts off? Well, next time we'll take up that subject. We'll take another three, the richest nation in the world, and we'll take a look at number 7, 8, and 9. If we were the richest nation in the world, we'd have a budget surplus every year. We would have zero inflation. And every home in America would be free and clear. We would be a nation of homeowners. We used to be a nation of homeowners. Everybody in the country owned his house. To the exclusion of the government, we actually paid for those houses with gold coin and extinguished those debts. Now, we're not doing that anymore and haven't been doing it for a long time. We would have a budget surplus. We don't have a budget surplus, and we haven't had one of those for a long time. We would have zero inflation, but we don't. We have 8 or 10% inflation right now as I speak. And as a result of that, we have number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and now number 7, 8, 9, which are not indications of the richest nation in the world. They're the indications of one of the poorest nations in the world. Hey, I'm about out of time, so I'm going to have to leave it right there, and we'll take it up right here next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review, which is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right.